This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us again. Well, the November 4th protests put together by leftist radicals over the weekend didn't end up amounting to much. And House Minority Leader Pelosi on Sunday said impeaching President Trump would not be a priority for Democrats if they win control of the House in the midterms. But that doesn't mean that the quest to destroy President Trump is over. In fact, as my next guest points out, no other American president has faced the level of opposition that Trump has faced in an attempt to overthrow the results of a Democratic election and inflict irreparable damage on our nation. And both his enemies on the left and on the right are involved. Well, joining me now is veteran journalist Edward Klein, who is former editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine and author of the great new book, All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. And it's great to have you here, Mr. Klein. How are you?
I'm great, Janet. Please call me Ed.
Okay.
I was listening to your introduction, and if the Democrats win over the House in 2018, and if Nancy Pelosi stands in the way of those left-wing Democrats to put impeachment charges, she's going to be thrown out, and they're going to vote in somebody else because the Democrats are absolutely determined to impeach Donald Trump if they can.
Yes, and you talked about that in your book, the fact that they're looking toward the midterms in order to get control back so they can do just that.
Exactly, and that's the danger, because if they do, that's, I think, will be the top of their agenda.
I agree. Well, this is very interesting to me how everything has unfolded since the election. And you're making this case that Donald Trump really is facing this unprecedented war to drive him out of office. Where do you see the effort having first begun? You talk about Loretta Lynch and Valerie Jarrett, the Obamas. Was there a particular moment where you can say that's where the whole effort began?
Yes, we can say that. In fact, it's in the very beginning of my new book, All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. There was a dinner meeting in the White House on December 16th, 6 weeks after the election, in which Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, and Valerie Jarrett, their advisor, invited Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, to this dinner. And at that dinner, she proposed that the names of Donald Trump's campaign aides, who were inadvertently picked up in national security intercepts, had nothing to do with their being in touch with Russians or anything like that, but there's those names be unmasked, because they were not supposed to be identified. They were supposed, because they're Americans, it would be illegal.
Right.
She wanted to unmask the names, distribute them widely throughout the intelligence community. We're talking about 16 different agencies, hundreds and hundreds of people, with the purpose of getting them leaked to the press and starting this story that there was collusion between the Trump people and the Russians. And that's where this plot to destroy Donald Trump all began.
Right. So now the question for a lot of people is, they've been following all of this, the allegations of Russia colluding with the Trump campaign, and so far they got nothing. They've got more on the Democrats on that front than they do on the Trump administration. They'll hear this and say, well, why aren't they being prosecuted for having done this? Why isn't this something that Congress is not getting on to? But does that kind of coincide with the fact that you have a lot of people in Congress who don't want Trump?
Well, you do. You have a lot of Republicans who are never Trumpers.
Right.
And, we've seen them talk. They've come out of the woodwork. Jeff Flake, Corker, McCain, yeah. On and on and on. And these people are naturally afraid, and a number of them are not even going to run again, because Donald Trump has threatened to take away the swamp and their power and the money source, which is, of course, the lobbyists in Washington who represent special interests, who give money to both the Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
making very little difference between these establishment characters.
Yeah, that's so true. Ben Sasse is another one who comes to mind.
Ben Sasse is another one, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So you identify in the book this war against Trump is being waged on these three fronts. You've got the deep state, you've got Congress, and then you've got the people on the streets. And I thought this was very interesting. You've got this FBI report that's being published for the first time in your book that really gives this powerful evidence confirming the existence of the deep state. Tell people a little bit about what's in that report.
Well, yes, the FBI, this is a field report to the director of the FBI from agents who infiltrated the meetings of the so-called deep state. These are rogue elements in the permanent bureaucracy, people who are employed by the federal government, having been appointed originally by Clinton and Obama, who are being taught by union organizers, community organizers, and other far left-wing groups how to sabotage Donald Trump's agenda by losing files, by deleting files from computers, by slow-walking orders by their superiors, by doing everything they possibly can, and, of course, by leaking to the press negative stories about Donald Trump. And this is happening in the Environmental Protection Agency, the Justice Department, the Interior Department, you name it. And it's something that we've never seen before, and it's a real threat to our democracy.
Right. Well, you talk about all these different agencies. How widespread is the movement, and to what extent would you say they're succeeding at undermining the president?
Well, you know, there's a whole question about why Jeff Sessions isn't doing more as Attorney General about Hillary. But let's put that aside for just a moment and talk about what Jeff Sessions has found. He's discovered, according to my reporting and in this book, All Out War, that his effort to defund, in other words, not give money to cities, so-called sanctuary cities, where undocumented illegal aliens are protected,
right,
that his efforts to do that are being blocked by the people who work for him in the Justice Department, not his top people, because those are people he's appointed, but people below them, right below them. And so they're not following orders and instructions. And so far, Jeff Sessions is, I'm told, he's beside himself over this. He's trying to root out these people, find out who they are, and fire them. It is very, very hard to fire federal bureaucrats. They're protected by, you know, their unions.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That is frustrating if you feel like the people who are working for you are actually trying to undermine what you're trying to do. And monumentally frustrating for Trump, because Trump is trying to do the right thing on defunding the sanctuary cities. And ultimately, he's Sessions' boss, so he's got to be way more frustrated than Sessions.
He is. He's frustrated about Sessions on a lot of, well, the Justice Department on a lot of levels, that which we just talked about, this sabotage. But he's also very frustrated, as he's made clear, that despite the fact that there are a number of prosecutors in the Justice Department who believe that Hillary Clinton should be investigated and that a new special counsel should be appointed to look into how she got $135 million to her Clinton Foundation while she was from Kremlin sources, by the way,
right,
or at least Russian-connected sources, while she was okaying the transfer of our uranium deposits to the Russians.
Horrible.
All that kind of stuff, plus, of course, using a unsecured email server and having confidential documents on that server, okaying her husband's, Bill Clinton's, speech in Moscow for $500,000. And we can go on and on. And there's a lot of stuff about Hillary Clinton, including what we've just learned, which is that the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee paid for this dossier that everybody's heard about, that comes from Kremlin disinformation sources. So talk about who's in cahoots and colluding with the Russians. That should be investigated. And that's one of the reasons, as you just said, President Trump is so frustrated.
Yes. And one of the things I want to ask you about, and we'll have time to do more of this when we come back from the break, is this report that came out last week that apparently Attorney General Sessions told a very small group of lawmakers in the fall, in September, he was recused from appointing a special counsel to look into the Uranium One and Fusion GPS scandals. I want to talk to you when we come back. We are with Ed Klein, author of All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today right after this.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
Last week, I stood up against the attacks on Judge Amy Barrett at the Seventh Circuit. She was shamefully attacked for her faith. Here's a clip of what I said.
The Christian dogma that a few find appalling embodies the best of humanity. It calls us to love others as we do ourselves, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, attend to the widow and the orphan, and to care for those in prison. It teaches us to be truthful, honorable, and content. It teaches us to respect governmental authority, and yes, it teaches judges to be impartial and to love justice. These character traits should be celebrated in any judicial nominee, religious or not.
Join us on the front lines. Call your senators now and urge them to fill vacant judicial posts. It's time to appoint the federal judges our nation needs. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to get your senator's info. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is John's story.
When our daughter Emma was born, my wife and I took a hard look at our finances for the first time, and we didn't like what we saw. My wife suggested that I call Trinity. Immediately when I spoke with the counselor for the first time, she was very helpful and put us on a plan for success. Right away, we knew we'd called the right place. We just want everyone out there who might be in our situation to know that there's help.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Ed Klein, former editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine and author of the new book called All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. And we were talking a little bit about what's been going on in the DOJ. And I'm curious to ask you, Ed, about this report on Jeff Sessions telling these lawmakers that he was recused from appointing a special counsel to look into the potential corruption over the Uranium One and Fusion GPS dossier work. I mean, this, people are now asking the question, is Sessions recusing himself from the Russian collusion investigation into Trump now impeding his ability to do the proper investigation into the DNC and the Clinton campaign?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Jeff Sessions has had a reputation of being a very solid conservative. He was the first person in the Senate, as you know, the first senator to come out in favor of Donald Trump during the primaries. Mm-hmm. He's very popular, or at least was, among his colleagues when he was a senator. But in fact, right now, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with Jeff Sessions because he has refused to open this investigation into Hillary Clinton. He claims, I'm not saying I agree with this, this is what he's saying. He's saying that he doesn't want to politicize the Justice Department.
But too late for that.
Too late for that, indeed. I think there's a very good chance that Jeff Sessions may not be our Attorney General for much longer.
Wow.
I've heard rumors, and actually they're more than rumors, they're reports, that Donald Trump may either replace him or he may resign or he may move Jeff Sessions to a different cabinet post and appoint a new Attorney General who will, in fact, open this investigation, which is certainly long overdue.
Absolutely. Now, I was curious about the Obama parts of your book, because one of the things that he announced before he was out of the White House was the fact that, yes, he was going to be living in Washington and he'd be training the next generation of community organizers. But from what you're saying in your book and what sources are telling you, he's smoking marijuana and playing video games, and he didn't have any interest in setting up a shadow government. So this would, I think, take a lot of people by surprise.
Well, it's in my book, All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. Everyone thought that, as you just said, that Obama was going to set up a kind of shadow government in the Calorama section of Washington, where he and Michelle bought an $8.1 million mansion. They're living in high society there.
Yep.
But according to my sources, despite all the efforts on the part of the Democratic Party to get the former president engaged, he's totally disengaged. He's, as you just said, playing video games like a teenager, going back to his Choom gang days in Hawaii when he smoked pot. He's popping gummy bears infused with cannabis. And all of this comes from a source of mine who actually has smoked marijuana with him since he left the White House.
Good grief.
And, you know, Donna Brazile is just coming out with a book in which she criticizes Obama for leaving the Democratic National Committee broke.
Yes.
He was urged by his wife and by Valerie Jarrett, according to my sources, to speak up and attack Donna Brazile, and he has no interest in doing that. He's very, very happy being a stoner ex-president.
Oh, man.
So I don't think you'll see I think you'll see him on the campaign trail in 2016 making a few speeches here and there for Democratic candidates, because he loves these adoring crowds. But he's not engaged in this resistance movement the way people thought he would be.
Well, and the resistance movement is interesting because you have Antifa, you talk about some of these other groups, It's Going Down and Final Straw and Refuse Fascism and all these other groups that many people assume, well, the Obama tentacles are probably all involved in that. There's Soros funding, there's OFA to consider. So there's really, though, not any direct link then, Obama pulling the marionette strings behind the scenes whatsoever?
Well, that's a very good question again. I think what you're seeing, and this again is based on my reporting in this new book, are the people who served under Obama in his administration and served in his campaigns who are beside themselves and are engaged in this resistance movement, and especially the big donors who made it possible for Obama to raise as much money as he did in his campaigns. As you just pointed out, George Soros, another person by the name of Tom Steyer, who has been funding TV commercials urging the impeachment of the president.
Yes.
We've never seen that before.
Yes.
And there are tons of other really rich men and women, all whom, by the way, I name in this new book, All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump, who are part and parcel of this resistance movement, as, by the way, are Hillary Clinton's campaign people, who are still bitter over losing the election, and are very much part of this effort to undermine, delegitimize, and ultimately, if they can, impeach Donald Trump.
Wow. Well, and the impeachment effort is ongoing. As you mentioned before, if they're able to secure the House and control of the House in the midterms, they have every intention of moving forward with impeaching Trump. But the problem is finding adequate grounds on which to do it. The collusion with Russia hasn't materialized. These allegations that he did nefarious things with these people, foreign officers who stayed at his hotel, none of that comes up. So now they're on this 25th Amendment quest. Mm-hmm. He's just not fit. But that doesn't fit either, right? He would have to be diagnosed with some disease that would render him incapable to be removed under the 25th Amendment, right?
Absolutely. And the 25th Amendment says that if the majority of the cabinet and decides to vote with the, I think, approval of the House to remove the president because he's incapacitated, and that's an important word, and as you say, a stroke or a heart attack or something really serious, then the vice president takes over. This is not going to happen. If such a coup d'etat took place, this country would be in a civil war. You can be sure of that.
Yeah. I think so, too. If they actually were able to get that done, I think they underestimate the fury of the American people who put Donald Trump in office. You see it all the time. It's a controlled fury, but I would be afraid that it would spill over if they actually went that far.
I agree with you. And we are in a kind of civil war in this society. Several people refer to the East Coast and the West Coast of America like parentheses around the real America.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of Americans that don't live on the East and West Coast, who, for all their doubts sometimes about his tweets and his behavior and so forth, agree with Donald Trump's agendas.
Yes.
Securing our borders, making us energy independent, passing tax reform so that this economy gets kicked into high gear, which it already is starting to do under Donald Trump, getting us the kind of respect that is our due around the world, which is you're seeing this happening right before your very eyes during this trip he's making to Asia. These are very popular policies.
True.
And I think that's why, in my view, this effort to delegitimize him should be brought to everyone's attention. And that's why I wrote this book, is so that people will understand why, what's happening, who's behind it, and how they can stop it.
Of course, it's really important. And I found it extremely disturbing. I've seen some reports on this as well, that these left-wing groups actually have met with Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Yes.
To plot Trump's destruction. What is going on there? Why doesn't the FBI move in and put a stop to all that?
Well, the FBI is on that case, or at least they were this past summer when these groups, these violent left-wing groups, went to Europe and did meet with Al-Qaeda and ISIS representatives. They know the names of the people. They're following them. I don't believe they've, as far as I know, made any arrests yet, but I think what they're hoping to get is to infiltrate these groups, because now they know who they are and how dangerous they are, because they're getting bomb-making instructions, toxic chemical instructions, very, very serious stuff, not just smashing windows. And I think this is, according to the FBI, and I quote this in my new book, the greatest threat to law enforcement since the 1970s and the Weather Underground.
Really? That's serious. It seems to be, what's really different, though, is back in the 70s, you didn't have this widespread governmental backing, you know, behind the scenes, where you have people within, you know, the bureaucracy, or even people who are politicians within major parties who are all for it. They might not say it publicly, but they're certainly not coming out and condemning it.
That's right. You know, it's interesting that in this new book of mine, All at War, that we're talking about, I print in total these FBI reports. Not one, and this is not just my reporting, this is the FBI reporting. These are documents that actually exist inside the FBI. Not one single mainstream media outlet has picked this up.
No. It was the first time I had read it, and I thought, you got to read Ed Klein if you want to know what's really going on.
Right.
You really do. So what is your prediction then, Ed? As you look at the landscape, I know nobody has a crystal ball, but do you predict that Trump will survive? What do you think will happen?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the American people. If they read books like mine, if they take action, if they vote the right way, if they let their Congress people know what they think, if they talk to their friends and neighbors, then I think that Donald Trump not only will survive, but will flourish. But if they are, what's the word I'm looking for? If they don't, if they just sit back and don't do anything, then they're going to get what they deserve, which is a country that will turn far to the left, become a Bernie Sanders country.
Yeah.
We have to stop that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, these left-wing groups are now talking about how they think socialism is great, how they think communism is great. Well, Donald Trump is the guy who can stop this, and that's why I've written this book, All at War.
People have to read it. Again, All at War, the plot to destroy Trump. Ed Klein with us. Ed, it's always an honor. Love the book, and I really appreciated your being here.
Thank you for having me, Janet.
Always glad to have you. Thank you so much. Ed Klein, we'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation. The fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. We are back. Well, it is a great and high calling to be a pastor, but with that calling can come some very high or sometimes even unrealistic expectations. We do expect a lot of our pastors, but do we really understand what they go through? As my next guest points out, the health of any church depends upon knowing the health of its pastor. And so we're going to talk about this today with Jimmy Dodd, founder and president of PastorServe, a ministry that provides care and counseling and friendship to pastors. He's been a pastor for more than 30 years himself and is here to talk about his new book. I like the title, Pastors Are People Too. And it's great to have you here, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm fine, Janet. Thank you very much. It's great to be on your show today. So thanks so much for the time.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's a great subject. You know a lot about this subject, and a lot of us lay people may not know so much about this subject, but a lot of people might just say, I know my pastor's a person. What am I doing wrong as a member of a church? And why do we need to pay attention to this issue of pastors being really regarded as people and not just spiritual giants?
Yeah, I guess that's a great question, Janet. You know, pastors have got struggles just like anybody else. They've got the same challenges. They've got issues in life and marriage and finances and parenting. They've got temptations. It just runs the whole gamut. Yet, you know, there's this sense amongst pastors so often that they just can't be real, that they can't be honest, because they have this fear of, if my church really knew me, my church, they really wouldn't like me. And if they didn't like me, I might not even have a job. And so I think that there is a fear that just grips a lot of pastors. So I just can't be real and honest, because if I share all the struggles in my life, it'll just really let people down. So I think that we're at a place where we're in a real pastoral crisis in this country, with more and more pastors leaving. And the story that we hear over and over again is, it was just unrealistic expectations, as the church really expected me to live a life, a real perfection that I just could not live, because I have struggles just like anybody else.
Oh, wow. When you talk about unrealistic expectations and how that trips up a lot of people in the ministry, men who want to leave the ministry over this such, you know, thing like this, what is it that people tend to put on pastors that makes them come to the conclusion, I can't do this anymore?
Yeah, gosh, that's a great question. I think it's just that the sense of, you know, I think that my pastor shouldn't struggle with the same things I struggle with. So if I'm a man and I'm struggling with porn and I'm thinking, man, I just really don't know where to go, but I think I'll talk with my pastor. If there's any sense that your pastor might have that same struggle, you think, well, there's no hope for me, because if my pastor struggles with these things, then I don't know where I would go for help. And so pastors, I think, feel this pressure of, okay, there's all these issues as far as marriage and life and everything else. And there's this expectation of, I've got this actually all right in my life, and because it's right in my life, I can share with you from my wisdom and experience. But the truth is, I think the pastors can share with you, but it's as one who's also in that struggle. It's as one who says, gosh, I understand, because you know what? Because it's a temptation also for me, and I have struggles in my marriage, and I struggle with my children, and I'm trying to learn to be more and more patient or just, you know, whatever it might be. And so I think that there's this sense in which pastors are real, you know, and it's a win-win, because I think the church feels more confident. Wow, I have a pastor that's real, and he's honest, and he's truthful, and I don't know pastor. Well, I shouldn't say that. There are very few pastors who have been really, really honest, and as a result, the church says, well, you're done, although that has happened. So there is, you know, for pastors, I think that there is a risk in that. There's a risk in saying, all right, if I'm completely honest, there might be some that might have some power in the church, you know, that they might be on a board, and they might say, I don't want to have a pastor that has these types of struggles. Yeah. And so, you know what, I think you ought to leave. But the issue is, the next pastor will have those same struggles, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because, for example, when you look at the qualifications for a pastor in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1, and it talks about the high holy calling, really, of being a shepherd over God's flock and having exemplary character and those sorts of things. I think a lot of people in the church are a little confused today about the difference between what a pastor ought to be and what the people in the pews ought to be. We're all supposed to be pursuing godliness, for sure, but we do all struggle with temptations. What would you say is the appropriate level of expectation that, well, I'm struggling in this area, but a godly man who's in my pulpit ought to not be struggling in this area. What do you think about that separation between pulpit and congregation, or is there one?
Well, I just think that there needs to be a sense in which you understand, okay, Paul wrote, gosh, I've been crucified with Christ, and I've got this old nature, and it's dead, and it's gone. And gosh, it's on the cross with Christ, my guilt and my shame.
Right.
And so we say, yeah, I want my pastors to understand that they've been crucified with Christ and that old nature is gone, and I want to have a pastor that really, really lives that. And yet that same person wrote, the things I hate, I do, and the things I want to do, I can't do.
Right.
God help me in Romans 7. And so I just think you have to understand, you know, that even though you might walk with Christ and you want to do everything you can to be more and more like Jesus, there is this nature within us.
There is.
And we're constantly fighting that. And it's this ongoing struggle of, gosh, the things I want to do, I just hate doing.
Right.
And so I don't think that the pastor has got to stand up and share all of his laundry with the church and say, gosh, here's all of my stuff. But there is a posture that comes through very loud and clear when you have a pastor who just says, listen, I need Jesus as much as you do. I've got to have, you know what, I have to have his grace as much as you do. And you know what, I don't think I'm way above you, and I don't think I'm above you at all. Because I know that I need Jesus just as much as you do. And just even those words can be a huge, just a real, real blessing, I think, to people to just say, gosh, I have a pastor that needs grace as much as I do. I have a pastor that's honest just about their struggles in life. And I have a pastor that knows that they've not conquered this, but it's a life day by day of just really, really actually depending upon Jesus. And that really blesses congregations, I believe.
It sure does. Now, when we talk about being a champion, as you do, I should say, as you talk about it in the book, that your pastor needs a champion, and it could be you. Where do you begin to really recognize that your pastor is a person and to be supportive right from the get-go?
Yeah. You know, we have talked with especially lots and lots of lead pastors who say, you know, I really fight for my staff, and I fight for my staff as far as their salaries, as far as their, as far as their days off and things, you know, things like that. And so you speak with the board, and I will really push for them just to be able to have just the love and just that overall support that they need. And yet I hear oftentimes, and yet I really feel like I have no one out there that really, really champions me.
Oh, wow.
And so I think it's really key that it might just be actually one, maybe one person on the board, or like on the elder team or on the district team, or you know, however that might work in your church, that really champions the pastor, that says, hey, listen, you know what, I want to ask you some questions every month and just walk through just kind of how things are in your life and how things are as far as your finances and things I can do to make you feel like you are really, really loved and appreciated. And just to have that one person, and it's amazing, just one person really championing, you know, that one can make just a massive difference. But it's just heartbreaking the fact that there are more and more pastors that we hear from them, and they say, you know, I just don't feel like I have one champion.
Ugh.
I just kind of sense that there's no one that really asked me those questions.
That's a shame. You would think that wouldn't be as widespread a problem as it is, but you're right. I also hear pastors saying that. It's very lonely. Sometimes they will say, being in a church, I feel like it's me against them sometimes.
It's very, very lonely. And you know what? You might have a large church as a pastor. Your church, you know, you might have a church of thousands and thousands, and you can still feel very isolated and lonely. So it has nothing to do with the church size. We've met with very, very, very small church pastors, and they have tremendous love and fellowship and just this great spirit of real community. And then large church pastors that you think it would be much, much easier, it oftentimes we hear from them that they feel very, very isolated and very, very lonely. And let me tell you, sin loves isolation. Mm. Sin thrives in isolation. And I think that's a major tool, I believe, of Satan, is to make pastors feel very isolated, like there's no one I can go to, there's no one I can speak with, I can't talk about these issues with anybody.
Absolutely. And it's so important to remember your pastor, obviously, is also part of the body of Christ. We're all the body of Christ. We're going to come back. Jimmy Dodd, his book, Pastors Are People Too. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today.
Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation present The Star, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. Bo the donkey and his stable of animal friends follow the star to become some unlikely heroes.
That light, that's the star. This is where it's been leading me.
What's his name?
His name is Jesus.
The Star, in theaters November 17th. More information is available at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. It is such an important subject. Pastors are people too. We sometimes forget that as we sit in the pews and we expect the man in the pulpit to do all and be all and say all and never sin and never have any moments where he has a bad day either. And yet we really need to support each other as part of the body of Christ. And we're discussing it with Jimmy Dodd, who is author of Pastors Are People Too. Jimmy, when we were talking about the expectations people have on pastors and coming into the church, and sometimes pastors feel like they're all alone, they don't really have anybody as their champion and sort of standing by them. One of the situations that will arise in churches, and you address this in the book as well, is friendship with the pastor. And we all struggle with this to some degree. I love my pastor. I want him there if somebody needs to be baptized or a funeral needs to be preached. But can I really be friends with him? Am I really allowed to be friends with my pastor? Does that cross some sort of invisible line? What are your thoughts on fraternizing within the congregation between pastor and parishioner?
Yeah, you can be friends with your pastor. Now, that I think has to be qualified, because it might be a large church and it might be that might be actually impossible. It might be, well, gosh, I have a, you know, church of like 1,000 people. So that might not happen, but I absolutely know that pastors need friends. And so that might be that you are out to say like a basketball game with like your pastor and you meet friends, you know what? Make sure that you say, this is my friend, not this is my pastor. Mm. Because I think that oftentimes there's always that, gosh, everywhere I go, I'm always the pastor. And you know what? There's times where you just want to be a friend. Actually, I think it could be very awkward at times, because there are those that might want to speak with you and might want to talk, and they learn that you're a pastor. And they can very quickly start to clam up and think, oh, gosh, I really, really apologize for my language this past half hour.
Yes.
I had no clue that you were a pastor. You know what? We want people just to be really, really honest with us and just to be really, really authentic with us. And so I think that just to know that, you know what, be his friend first and then say, you know, and also he happens to be actually my pastor. But pastors love to be known as, you know, this is my friend. That just makes a big difference.
Yes. Now, what about managing your pastor's time? Clearly, it's a 24/7 job. Certain weeks, if you have an accident in the congregation or sickness or what have you. I have seen this go both ways in my life. I have seen churches that have been very, very good about allowing the pastor to have family time and to relax and have sabbaticals every few years and those sorts of things. And other times I've seen in churches situations where the pastors are expected to always be on call. And if you're spending a day where you went to the, you know, a movie or something with your wife, then you're slacking. How do you, as a church member, address the issue of time management and how much you really should expect your pastor to be on call for you?
Yeah, that goes back, I believe, to the whole issue as far as expectations. That I think if you ask the average person in like the church about their, just about the time of the pastor, and they say, well, gosh, I expect my pastor to preach and do the preparation and to be involved in a small group and do lots of counseling and to do some marriages and then some funerals and on, it's amazing. But if you start to actually add up all of those hours, you just start to see, okay, this is unbelievably unrealistic, because most people have got this expectation of, okay, if you do everything that I really believe that you should do, you would work crazy hours. I mean, just absolutely stupid hours every week. And so we know there has to be that point in which you have some boundaries. And so you say, okay, what are your expectations as far as your pastor? We have found that a really good work week as far as a pastor is about 53 hours. That's oftentimes real healthy. Now, there are times and seasons in which you will work a lot more around Christmas and Easter. So there are times, you know, where that whole thing obviously ramps up.
Right.
But you've got to be realistic as far as expectations. Because if you expect your pastor to do everything, that means there will be a big piece of his life that's got to be sacrificed. So you think, okay, there's his job, and there's sleep, and there's time to eat, and there's exercise, and there's time with his wife and kids, and that's actually about it. So you think, okay, well, if he works a lot more hours than he should work, that means there's going to be one piece of that that has got to get sacrificed, which means that they will start to sleep less hours, or they won't spend time with their spouse or their kids. So you have to have boundaries, because if you don't, you will work around the clock.
That's true.
And so we just constantly stress this, because we have a call that we have almost actually every day. And it's a call that just breaks our heart. And it goes like this. It's, I'm really struggling right now between my ministry and my family. And I just can't keep that whole thing in balance. And I'm just struggling so much. What do I do? And we say the same thing every time. That's the wrong question, because all of life is ministry, and your family is your primary ministry.
Oh, good.
So when you leave the church and you spend time with your spouse, that's your main ministry. So when you have been there at the church for hours and hours and hours, and yet you leave to go spend time with like your kids' game, that's powerful, because that's your primary ministry. And so there needs to be this great sense that the church knows, okay, this pastor's family, that's their primary ministry. And we cannot cheat them through these crazy expectations. And so I think that there just has got to be this, okay, I know that my pastor works hard. I know very, very few lazy pastors. Most work just crazy hours, and you have to really, really just say, hey, you know, you've just got to back off a little bit.
Good.
But just to have those those things which are very clear. So I'd say that it's best to actually start with the hours as far as, okay, what do I expect as far as hours? And you know, and that there might be a church, you know, that says 50. There might be a church that says 60. But if you start with a job description, that oftentimes gets things very, very imbalanced, because you start to just tack on job after job after job, and you don't think about the time it takes. But after a while, you've got this massive job description, and you think, okay, to really do this job, it'll take actually about 90 hours a week.
Wow.
Which means that oftentimes I will really, really struggle in my marriage with my kids. I won't get much sleep. I'll be exhausted. I'll be in bad health. And so the church becomes very, very frustrated. Well, gosh, you're a pastor and yet you're struggling in your marriage and all these other areas. Well, I don't have the time to do these things because of the expectations that you've placed upon.
Yes. And it seems as if that's a really important aspect of these things, that we set boundaries at the beginning when the pastor is hired. You're going to get this day off and we're going to protect your time. And that's where I think a lot of laymen or members of the elder board or what have you can be really helpful. We had a pastor like this growing up, and he was always cheating on the time he was supposed to be off. He was supposed to have the day off, and he'd be out there mowing the lawn in the church lawn, and somebody would come out and say, go home. We'll get somebody else to do that. So that seems to be a good thing, too, if the congregation really sees him as a person to be able to say, if you're overdoing it, we're going to call you on it and you know, make sure that you're getting the rest that you need so you can really not burn out.
That's absolutely right. And so I got to just love that whole thing of, hey, you know what? Go home. Because
yeah.
that's a pastoral champion right there.
Yeah.
That's a champion who says, listen, it's your day off. Don't mow the yard today. Go home.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, that helps him also, I think, feel loved and cared for. So when he is back in the game the next day, he's that much more motivated. Oh, they really love me. They love me enough to tell me to go home and spend time with my family for once.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, that's great.
That's exactly right.
Well, and one more thing that I think is also, there's so much to talk about and it's all in your book, but praying for your pastor. I think a lot of us slip on this. We just assume he's being prayed for. He's the pastor. But what advice would you give to Christians about making sure that you're covering your pastor in prayer all the time?
Yeah, I think it's great to just make just a really basic, very, very small commitment and just say, I will pray for my pastor each day. It might be a minute. It might just be a short prayer. You know what? It might just be, God, I've just prayed that this day that my pastor would really sense your presence of your Holy Spirit. And I pray that as they walk through life, that they would know that you really, really love. I mean, just very basic, basic prayers. Mm-hmm. But just to really say, you know what? I want to pray for my pastor each day. We strongly encourage that. We have a text line that we have built over the years. And if you text the word pastor, P-A-S-T-O-R, to 74574, you will have a short text each day that says, pray this for you, you know, pray this today. And it's just going to have just a short prayer, but that can be just a great guide for how to just pray every day. And if you just say, hey, pastor, you know what? I'm praying for you every day. That is such a tremendous encouragement to pastors.
It is.
To know, wow, my church prays for me each and every day. That will bless your pastor.
That is awesome. That's awesome. Well, we're out of time, but the book Pastors Are People, to pastorserve.net, the website. Jimmy Dodd, thank you so much, Jimmy, for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be on your show, Janet.
Oh, it's my honor. God bless you and thanks. And thanks so much for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time. This hour has been brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation. The fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.